Blog Talk Radio.
There is no earthly way of knowing.
Good man, a lot of fun.
Which direction we are going?
Directly El Camino. It would have been DWI.
Have reached a tipping point.
Good evening. Good evening and welcome to an exotic episode of Tipping Point. I am Stephen Platinum, Porterdale's golden son, and I am joined by the lovely Miss Rachel and the venerable Larry Goodman. How are you guys doing tonight?
After this weekend, I'm doing just wonderful.
Well, obviously this is a very special episode of Tipping Point. Not only are we going to, I'm sure, have to address what happened at PCW, we have exotic Adrian Street, the man, the myth, the legend. I think that's a word that's thrown around very loosely, especially in wrestling, this idea of who's a legend. I think it is absolutely undeniable that exotic Adrian Street is a legend. Wouldn't you agree, Larry?
I could not agree more. This is a true legend of the wrestling business. No two ways about it.
I when it was even discussed that it might be a thing, I remember being very excited, and I just stumbled upon a number of like cassette tapes that I had. And I remember, you know, imagine what I could do to you. I remember being I stumbled upon that tape. I bought it in the store, but the words were kind of rubbed off of the tape. And all of that kind of stuff. I mean, it's definitely something that got played. I remember when they would play. I mean, he had runs just about everywhere. You know, he had a brief Mid-Atlantic run. And, I mean, he was that dude, man. If there was a wrestling game, if there were like wrestling board games or card games that were out, you would always have a representation of, you know, they tried not to use copyright anything, right? But you always had a guy that was exactly like exotic Adrian Street. So that's really exciting.
Go ahead, Steve.
Oh, no. I was going to say, actually, before I ask you about Peach State, because that sounds like it was phenomenal, with another bona fide legend, Jim Cornette was there. Rachel, something that I think is interesting, and you might want to ask exotic Adrian Street about, I don't know if you had any questions ready, but something that I find really remarkable is how he was able to stay in the wrestling business and stay involved with it. I mean, he wrestled up until like a few years ago, but realistically, he made his money and continued to be involved because of making gear. In fact, I believe that he made the Dude Love gear for Mick Foley. And he had a wrestling school. But I seem to remember something happened to it. I think it was like, I mean, because he's a Florida guy, right? I think that's right.
Yeah.
And I think a hurricane actually damaged his school, and I don't know if that ever opened again. So that might be a couple of things you want to ask him about. But Larry, tell us about Peach State. So Jim Cornette was there. I have to say, if I wasn't otherwise indisposed, I would have loved to come to the Jim Cornette experience. So can you kind of, and that was the kind of like talk back that they had before the actual show, right? I mean, can you walk us through that?
Right. He talked for over an hour, and basically a lot of it was people asking him about different individuals he's encountered through the years. Jerry Jarrett, Ole Anderson, Shawn Michaels in particular. Oh my God, no love lost there. He said Shawn Michaels was a whiny, obnoxious prick.
Wow. So he's still amazing. Makes
yes.
me happy.
Yes. And my question to him was about if he had it to do over again with Smoky Mountain, would he do anything differently? And his answer was that he felt like they did the right things, but at the wrong time. That when he got involved in Smoky Mountain, he thought wrestling was at low ebb in the, 92. He thought it was at the bottom. And he said, but he was wrong. It got worse. And then by the time, it got worse over the course of Smoky Mountain. And then by the time they were done, they finished in 95, within a couple years,
oh boy,
of course, wrestling had one of its hottest periods ever.
Yeah.
And another, you know, the other, he also had a lot to say about Paul Heyman, and of course he has, you know, as I'm sure you guys know, he has a lot of mixed feelings about Heyman, and he said, you know, he gave Heyman a lot of credit for that he's still doing it, he's still in the business, and he gave him credit for doing something he can't do, which is do business with people that he doesn't like. He says Heyman is able to do that. And he said, but I wouldn't believe anything the guy said if his tongue was notarized.
Nice. I definitely have more questions about the Jim Cornette experience and the Peach State show, but you know that does bring up an interesting point. And someone was saying that recently. I was just talking to people. I mean, every day I talk about wrestling, every single day. And somebody pointed out that they thought that it was amazing that I could do business with people that I didn't necessarily like or completely respect. And to me, that just seemed part and parcel of being in the wrestling business. I mean, I guess in that sense, I would lean closer to Heyman than Cornette. But at the same time, I mean, Cornette, he certainly, when things folded between him and Ring of Honor, he had very strong opinions about certain people who worked at Ring of Honor. Not really the wrestling people, but sort of more the bureaucrat types they had to deal with. Did Heyman get into anything about Ring of Honor or TNA or any of that, or any of his like sort of famous falling out with people?
You know, Cornette really, I missed the first few minutes, but he really didn't talk much TNA or Ring of Honor. It was more about the stuff from the 80s, the Midnight Express, working with Bill Watts. It was more from that area that people were curious about. Didn't really ask him much about Ring of Honor.
Which I guess stands to reason. If you're going to go see Jim Cornette, if you're going to kind of go out of your way to see it, it's probably because you remember a certain era of Jim Cornette. Either the period where he was a manager, both for Watts and then for Crockett and any number of other people, or you're going to remember when he kind of, you know, put out his own shingle with Smoky Mountain. I guess you wouldn't really be interested in hearing about, like, if you were really interested about that kind of thing, you would already know it anyway. Goodness knows he's done like a ton of shoots about, you know, the people, especially TNA, but a little bit about Ring of Honor. Is there anything that you found out about Jim Cornette that you did not know or a story that you had not heard before?
Well, I hadn't heard the story about Ole Anderson saying that, you know, he, of course he said Ole likes to smile first thing in the morning so he can get it out of the way. And that that Ole thought he was a dumb fuck. But what he later said was, but, you know, there's so many other dumb fucks that have come along since you came in the business that you've gone up the ladder by doing nothing.
Wow. Wow. one thing about the Jim Cornette experience, Larry, did it surprise you that, I mean, it looked like there weren't a ton of people there.
No.
I think it was an extra, I mean, it was, what was it, $6 tops?
$6.
I mean,
16 for the combo ticket. 16. So, yeah, I was really surprised more people didn't turn out. You know, the people who turned out loved it and were really into it and asked really good questions, but not that many, you know, maybe 30 people, 40 maybe.
What?
Wow.
Yeah.
And Cornette didn't really seem to move the needle as far as the show itself. You know, Peach State Drew definitely a respectable and a great 225, but that's not really out of that's I guess online to what they've been doing. What does that tell you? I'm sorry, Rachel. What did you want to say?
I was going to say I'm curious because Steve and I had kind of talked about this. Of the people that were there for the Q&A session, was it mostly fans, or were there a lot of guys that maybe kind of forego the weekend and came to get to ask questions about anything more in-depth business related?
No, it was fans, and specifically fans that wanted to hear him reminisce about the old days.
Wow. So, even wrestlers, there weren't wrestlers who came in to be able to interact with you. I don't even know.
Been one or two who were listening from, around the side there who were there early, but not in any sizable number by any means.
I can't even wrap my mind around that. Rachel, can you wrap your mind around that if you were in the area that you don't go see Jim Cornette?
No,
I mean, I know you didn't grow up
5,
watching 000, him like I did, but
there's 5,000 shows, but it's also, I've been exposed to Jim Cornette, definitely, and I love hearing him talk. There's the way that he speaks always makes me laugh, but he's got a lot of great information. I mean, anyone that every other word is a cuss word is great in my book, but I mean, if it was something that I wasn't already in Porterdale, I would have been there. So it's just one of those things, there's so much information you could have had. I don't understand why guys don't take the time to access some of these resources that came in. And for $6, that's
Agreed.
The really depressing point, because we've had at PCW, we've had seminars that I think were more like $20. So you can't go pay $6 and sit for an hour or whatever and good information going forward. It's just... Someone took too many chair shots to the head.
I can understand why the wrestlers wouldn't have, in the sense that that's not really what he does at those kinds of things. Now, I'm sure I would think the guys backstage, Bennett, were able to pick his brain, and he provided the finish for the Sermon Blue match, which worked beautifully. But, yeah, I mean, he wasn't talking current stuff. I imagine,
the guy's got such
a gift for gab.
You said that was one of the questions that they asked, though. So if someone went in and said, despite all the things that happened between you and this company, what's something that you would say for someone wanting to work there? I mean, it's just a matter of going and asking for the information. He was there and ready to give it. So there was no reason for people to not be there to further their careers or get advice on ways to do that.
No, I think you're right.
Yeah.
There is no question that he shied away from. None.
Nor has there ever been. I guess maybe I'm a fool because I'm just a little blown away. Jim Cornette is, and maybe I've talked about this before, Jim Cornette is no fan of mine. I've met him on a few occasions. He actually came to, when we were doing shows at Masquerade, we did one WrestleMania week, the Thursday of WrestleMania week when it was in Atlanta. And, Ring of Honor, of course, had shows on that Friday and Saturday, and Jim Cornette was still with them. And so him and Gary Juster rolled in the door and came and watched the show, and Jim had his critiques. And every time he and I talk, it's mostly of the role of, kid, you're doing this wrong and you're doing that wrong. Well, I mean, I love it. Right? I mean, it doesn't bother me because it's somebody to learn from who's been there and done that. And furthermore, I mean, whenever I have major decisions to make, I've written Jim Cornette before, and he always gives a very terse, honest response. But why somebody would not access him when you have that ability? I mean, maybe it sounds like I'm coming down too hard about this. I don't get it. I get it if you were having to do a show. I don't get it if you were doing a crappy show or if you weren't doing anything, why you wouldn't pony up $6 and go and watch Jim Cornette. What did you like best about him being in the Peach State show itself? Of course, he was there managing, as was Al Getz. And Al Getz, I think, was just over the moon to get to do something with Jim Cornette, huh?
Yeah, yeah, he was pumped, and he brought his A game for that main event. Al did. I think the thing that I enjoyed the most about Cornette was hearing him sell and set up that match for the next show. Oh my God, there's just nobody who I can think of who could do that better than Jim Cornette. He just did a wonderful job of setting up the Dean Renaro rematch.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just awesome, awesome stuff. What were your big takeaways from the Peach State show? Obviously, you liked the show quite a bit. Again, you can always read Larry's show reports on Georgia Wrestling History in the news and notes section. But what's the big takeaway? Like, where does Peach State seem like they're going for the next few shows?
Well, this would seem to be a pretty big blow-off show that they're going to be doing at Thanksgiving with, two big gimmick matches and too much challenging Ray for the title. That would seem to be a show they're pointing towards, and beyond that, I really don't have a good idea because it seems like they've got a lot going on this show Thanksgiving weekend.
Yeah.
I did want to comment on the fight in the crowd there. Which was, again, only at Peach State do you get that kind of activity with women actually brawling on the floor in the crowd. I know you've had some awesome stuff happen at Platinum too, but these were just two women in the crowd that got into it, and one of them was the mother of Glenn Chips Matthews, who wrestles for AWE. Now, I was on the other side of the building.
Oh, my
I didn't
goodness.
See exactly what happened, who threw what punch, or anything like that. But I know there's been some back and forth about Glenn Matthews being involved in this at all. And, I think it was some folks saying that, well, it was his mom. It was good for him to get in there and take care of his mom. On the other hand, if he's a trained professional, if he's really a professional wrestler and a pro, to me, the thing to do would have been to protect his mom and break it up.
Yeah. What would Bill Watts have said? He's just like, your mother better not lose or she's out of a job. Your mom better not lose. Never in front of the marks, kid. Wow. I gotta ask this because Larry, because I'm just such a huge fan of Bill. I love Bill Watts, man. Bill Watts made me seriously think about like how wrestling could be. Yeah, and give me one Jim Cornette thing about Bill Watts, if you could.
I probably should not have mentioned that because he really didn't talk about Watts. He talked more about
okay.
wrestling in that area. Said that they were talking about the Midnight Express team and which did what was his favorite team. Well, and he said he liked both versions, and he said that he thought Stan Lane was better because of the cosmetics for the Carolina and, that era, the Georgia era. But that Condry was better for Louisiana because he didn't think Stan would be up for fighting those fans every night like he had to in Louisiana.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But he didn't really – if he talked about Watts specifically, I'm sorry, I missed that part.
Really great. Speaking of fighting fans, so for those who don't know, at PCW – there had been trouble brewing, since I haven't been there. I'm there off and on. So Matt Hankins runs the show. I think it's one of those like secrets that's not really a secret. And on Saturday, they had the women's tag, which was Rachel and Latasha taking on Dementia DeRose and Sue Young in a phenomenal match. I mean, the girls, spots were done over the top rope to the floor and all this kind of stuff.
Well, at the conclusion of that match, Rachel had left that match early with a supposed injury. But the
I don't
big
know what
reveal.
You mean supposed.
Yeah, no, yeah, it wasn't, clearly. But, you know, the big thing was Carpenter was there. Hankins was lured into the ring after Carpenter leveled Shane Mackey, who was visiting and did commentary. And in came Hankins, and then the big reveal happened after I bloodied Hankins that it was me, it was Jeff, it was Rachel, and it was Carpenter, and that we were forming an alliance in order to kind of return Platinum Championship Wrestling to what I think it was and kind of try to wrest it from Hankins and some of the guys. And, you know, other places, I guess that would have been enough. But again, a lot of people were taking up for Hankins, and we were, what Jeff, Rachel, Carpenter and I had talked about is, we're there to sort of send a message to Hankins. And once I found out Mackey was there, I wanted to send a message to him too, because those were the two guys that I felt like had started PCW on this road where it was not the show that I wanted it to be. And I guess Sacred Ground in Avondale reminded me of that. Like, that Sacred Ground was the PCW that I conceived. And I feel like Mackey and Hankins have sort of accommodated Porterdale too much, down to saying that they should call it Porterdale Championship Wrestling and all this kind of stuff. So that's what that was about. Now, everybody else just sort of got in the way. Like, when Johnny came down, you know, Devlin Valick kind of got beat down by Bill the Butcher and Dementia and Trevor Aeon. And Johnny came in the ring, and quite frankly, I'm happy for Johnny that he's a star. But again, he's another guy who I think owes his career to me. And I just felt like he was being disrespectful, and Rachel cut off his hair. So that happened. And then Brian Blaze was hung. That was really the Bullets call. Let me say that. That was not mine. I didn't know Trey brought a rope, but Brian tried to interfere, and so they took care of him. And then Mason showed up, and he got beat up. And Quasi, I think that was more of a – Rachel, would you say that was more of a Jeff thing, where I think Jeff sort of resents that Quasi is sort of being put in a category with him. And, I mean, I'm just being honest. Jeff might get mad that I'm saying this. But, you know,
no,
so
you know
Quasi
what? We're all in
yeah.
agreement on what's going on here, so I think you should speak your mind on it.
Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right.
So Quasi came down, and he was kind of asking, hey, guys, I would have helped you with all of this. And Jeff kind of took it upon himself to put him down, and then we tarred and feathered him. So we just – the goal was to sort of go all out, and that's what happened. And it was a packed house, which was great, because I wanted as many people to see it as possible. It was in some ways very reminiscent of – when the Empire took over, in the sense that it was a show that was already a big deal, and then the big thing happened at the end that nobody knew about. So it's going to go. I mean, Rachel lives in Orlando now, so she and I, it's very easy for her and I to come down to PCW. So that's what happened on our end. Before we have Adrian Street on, though, Larry, I definitely wanted to give Empire a nod, because they did their big fall show. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I know nothing about the Empire show. Scott Hensley was going to provide a report if he's written it or put it up. I'm sorry, I
he
have
did.
Not
he,
yet
he put
seen
a,
it.
He put a report. He has. He's put a report out. And
okay.
So from what I saw then in the recall, you know, the big match was, of course, you know, who was going to be on the face side of the equation to take on White Rose. And I'm sorry, I forgot who else was on their team. I love the White Rose gimmick so much. But that was the big deal on the show. But they had a title switch in a four-way match. And new tag champ. So, I mean, obviously a huge show. We wanted, you know, by the end of this show,
I'm going to go find that Hensley report and read it, because I definitely think Empire should get their due on that one.
Yeah, let's circle back around to that, because we are now joined by one of the true legends of wrestling, a gentleman who wrestled for over 50 years, wrestled in seven different decades, has made some great gear, has written seven books now. We're joined by the one and only, the exotic Adrian Street. Welcome to the show, sir.
Nice to be on, Larry.
Adrian, the other co-hosts here are Stephen Platinum and Rachel Freeman. So you're on with three folks tonight.
Oh, okay. Well, nice to meet you all.
Nice to meet you, sir.
Absolutely.
Mr. Street, it's so hard to know where to begin. I guess one of the things I'd like to know is what possessed you to get into pro wrestling rather than into coal mining like your father had for so many years?
Oh, come on. Have you ever been down a coal mine? It's the most horrible job you can possibly imagine. I've had a number of jobs, including boxing on a fairground boots, and I can't box. I can fight, and I can wrestle, but boxing is something entirely different, you know? I was starving to death at the time. I'd run away from home. I ran away from the coal mines to London. I had a job initially, but then I lost it and work was really hard to get at that time. And that was right in the middle of the time when all the race riots and everything like that were going on. People couldn't get work. I ended up boxing on a fairground booth. I was boxing anywhere between four and seven times in one day. And like I say, I can't box. And I was getting I was getting about $2 a fight.
$2 a fight?
Yeah.
And then how did they transition into wrestling?
I mean, the reason I went to London in the first place was to follow my dream of being a professional wrestler. But the thing is, I went to the big time promoters in London. They were Dale Martin's. They were part of Joint Promotions, and I went to those. I checked those out and told them I wanted to be a professional wrestler. And I want to start now, and they said it don't work like that. Go away. Come back when you're older and you're bigger and you're like an amateur champion. I was 16 at the time. I was 16 at the time and weighed about 144 pounds. But I was determined, and anyway, I managed to get my first professional wrestling match for the Independence. I didn't even know there was any such thing as Independence when I went up there first. But anyway, I started wrestling for the Independent promotions. And the first contest I had was in a place called, it was in Addington Hotel. And that was August the 8th, 1957. I was 16 years of age. The first contest I ever had, actually, was the main event. They actually thought I knew what professional wrestling was about, and I did not have a clue. I was terrible. The guy I wrestled with, I didn't know at the time he was supposed to win, but I didn't understand what they were talking about. I grabbed his arm. As soon as we got into the ring and we linked up, I took him in an arm bar, threw my feet up in the air, smashed his face into the canvas, dislocated his shoulder, and the contest was over in less than 2 minutes. I walked back. I walked back to the dressing room like I owned the place. Like, where's my first championship match? And they said, you silly butts, what the hell are you doing out there? And I was supposed to get £2.10 for that fight. That would have been about $5, I guess. But they cut my wages. I don't think they'd have given me any money at all. They cut my wages by a couple of dollars. And the only reason that they give me more work was I had to take the place of the guy that I put out, because I had him main event all over the south of England at the time, and he ended up in hospital. and they asked me to take his place, which, of course, I was very happy to do.
Now, you didn't start out as exotic Adrian Street. Am I correct? I read in preparing for this that you more were a fan of Buddy Rogers. Is that correct?
I was a big fan of Buddy Rogers, but also Don Revere Jonathan. And when I first started wrestling, I wrestled with Kid Tarzan Jonathan. Well, I was going to be Kid Jonathan, actually, but the same promoter that I was just talking about, he said, "You look like Tarzan." He said, "What do we call it, Tarzan Jonathan?" I said, "Kid Tarzan Jonathan." And the reason I insisted on that bit is that I was already posing for physique magazines, and they called me Kid Jonathan in those magazines. So I wanted to hang on to that. That title. Yeah, Don Lee Jonathan was my big hero. But when I finally got my break, which was about 4 years later, with a big time promoters. They didn't like the name Kid Tarzan Jonathan, and they called me Adrian Stewart, first of all. And I said, "I don't want that name. It's a Scottish name. I've got nothing against the Scots, but my name is, if I'm not going to be Kid Tarzan Jonathan, then I'll be Adrian Street instead, if you don't like that name. But Adrian Street is my real name." But anyway, the funny thing is, when I started wrestling for the big-time promoters, there was a guy called Charles Masker who used to do all my writing for him. He was originally from Canada, but he wrestled in the States as well when he was younger as Spider Masker, and he knew Buddy Rogers very well. And apparently I reminded him of him, especially the way I was training, like doing sort of long walks, and I was like really sort of careful the kind of food that I ate and all that kind of stuff. And it was him that actually started calling me Nature Boy Adrian Street. And it was because of that that I bleached my hair blonde and started getting fancy robes to live out, you know, to try to live up to that image. The people over there didn't take it the way it was presented. And instead of them going like, "Oh, you know, what Cliff was looking at last week," because my chest was 48 at the time, my waist was 27, had a great suntan, bleached my hair blonde, I thought it was fantastic. But instead of them appreciating it the way I was trying to present it, it was like, "Ooh, Mary, isn't she cute?" I thought you bosses. That wasn't the response I was looking for, but it was a terrific response, so I went with the flow. I said, "If that's what you silly bosses want, that's what you get." But getting back to Don Leo Jonathan, I never met him in my life until I proposed to my wife, Linda, in the Cauliflower Alley Club in 2005. And I never met him until the night before we got married, and he agreed to be my best man. So my childhood hero from the time I was about 12, was actually my best man. The guy that married us, Jason Saunderson, he's on a short list for being the Bishop of America, actually. But he used to wrestle professionally as the Wolfman. The guy that gave Linda away was Carl Lua, and he is like one of the first two promoters I ever wrestled for in the States. The guy that actually played the wedding march is the son of Paul Bosch, who was a very good friend of mine.
Wow.
And young Joey Bosch had his own show at the time in the Barbary Coast Hotel and Casino. But he came to the Cauliflower Alley Club where Linda and I got married. Linda and I have been together since 1969, but neither one of us was actually interested in actually being married. But the thing is, in 2001, I got throat cancer and I was told I was going to die.
Yeah.
The guy that... the doctor, Dr. Lurton, who actually diagnosed all the thing and everything like that, oh, Mr. Straight, he said, I'm going to give it you straight. He said, you're not going to make it out of this. He said, I suggest you go home and put your affairs in order. And I said to him, I ain't dying yet. I said to him, I ain't dying yet, mate. There's too many people in the world I haven't pissed off yet. People tell me I'm supposed to do something that I don't agree with. I won't do it, and dying is definitely one of them. But the thing is, I really was. I'm going to live until I'm 100 if he kills me. But anyway, it was a close call. I mean, I was really, 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 very sick. And Linda was by my side all the time. And I mean, the thing is, when I started recovering from that, I thought to myself, if I died then, you know, the fact that we had that illness, everything went south and all the rest of it. And financially, it almost wiped us out. And I thought to myself then that Linda deserves an awful lot more than being left in the lurch like she would have been if I turned around and died at that time, like I was told I was going to.
Yeah.
So I made my mind up then that we should get married so that way, if I died, everything that's mine is hers then, you know? Wow.
I wanted to ask you, Adrian, about a story I ran across in preparing for this interview about a run-in you had with a gentleman named Jimmy Seville, who was a DJ and sometimes wrestler in Britain, who, of course, you know, some very negative things came out about him later. Could you tell us about that?
Well, in actual fact, I've written about it. I'll give you a brief outline, but the whole story is in one of my books. It's in the whole story is in Sadists in Sequence, I do believe. The whole story is in that in detail. But I'll give it to you in a nutshell.
Okay.
Jimmy Savo was like the biggest, hottest DJ in Britain at the time. And he used to do all kinds of things, like to sort of try to put himself over as a tough guy and everything. He did all the basic training, I mean, for publicity, of course. He did all the basic training for the Royal Marines. He'd do all kinds of things that was, you know, that you would associate with tough guys. And he came into professional wrestling. And unfortunately, a lot of the promoters actually started using him, not because he was a wrestler like he claimed to be, but because he was such a big name, and they thought he'd put asses on seats, which he did. You know, because it was Jimmy Savo. You know, he was like a superstar at the time. Anyway, this is what happened. At that particular time, I was doing a feud. We had a big blood feud going with George Kidd. He was a lightweight champion of the world. And in my estimation, he was the best technical wrestler that ever put a pair of boots on in history. He was absolutely fantastic. But anyway, I had a contest with him in a big arena, Nottingham Ice Ring. And I beat him in 7 minutes. Not only did I beat him with 2 straight submissions, but I put him in hospital. He ended up in Nottingham Infirmary. Anyway, he wasn't even on the next show. And I mean, none of the big stars wanted to miss any of those big shows and everything like that because they were really good players. But he wasn't on the next show because of the injury that I'd given him. But he'd gone into sort of strict training and all the rest of it, and we're going to wrestle not on the next show because he's not going to be on it, but on the show after. Now, get this for being a stupid promoter. You're going to think for him very often. In the meantime, they put me on with Jimmy Savile. I mean, can you imagine? The guy's a joke. He's not a bloody wrestler at all. Anyway, the promoter came into my dressing room with Jimmy Savile. And they said, like, oh, this is your opponent. And I was pretty much, I was already really, really pissed off. the promoter says to me, Adrian, he said, I'd like you to do a draw. Can you imagine? Can you imagine?
Yeah.
I've just beaten the champion of the world, the best technical wrestler ever in the history of professional wrestling. I've beaten him in 7 minutes and put him in hospital. And I go, normally, I mean, like an average match would be 40, 45 minutes over there. If I did a draw with George Kidd in a championship match, we would be in a ring for 90 minutes.
Oh, my gosh.
Getting back to this, they actually wanted me to do a draw with this clown, this joke, this bloody idiot and all the rest of it. I said, I'm not doing it. I said, no way. I said, what are you trying to do, ruin your own bloody business? You know, I said, can you imagine the champion of the world can't beat me? I put him in hospital in 7 minutes. You bring a joke into the business, and you expect me to do a draw with him. So you're saying that Jimmy Savile, like a joke that's not even a wrestler, can do something that George Kidd can't do? I said, no way. And the promoter really said the wrong thing. He said, don't underestimate Jimmy Savile Street. He said, he's tough. He's done this. He's done that. I said, we'll see. I said, we'll see what he can do when we're in the dressing room. Well, Linda was there watching the match. This is before she became a professional wrestler herself. She was there watching the match. She said, you look like a bloody starving fox after a chicken. I tore him from arsehole to breakfast time. And I grabbed all of him by his hair and yanked him backwards so hard that I turned him upside down. The first thing they hit the ground was his head. She said, you look, I said, she said, you, not only did you look like a fox, she said, but when he was running away from you and you're chasing him around the ring, all his hair, he'd sort of dyed it all the colors you could possibly think of. And it was coming out in wisps every time I hit him, like every time I dragged him around by his hair. There was wisps everywhere. He was running away from me, and I'm chasing him around the ring. Anyway, I'm very happy to say that he never, ever, ever wrestled again. I ended his career. all that stuff about him sort of having sex with children, little boys and little girls, nobody knew about it at that time. But yet, he was supposed to the wrestlers, like, oh, yeah, when I go back, he lived in some sort of high-rise, sort of fancy place. He said that it would be crowds, absolutely crowds of young girls. And he actually said young girls, but we just didn't realize how young he was talking about.
Right. Oh, my gosh.
But he said, like, he'd go along and he'd check them out. And he says, okay, I'll have you, and you. The rest of you can come back tomorrow and try again. But they were children. They weren't, you know, you're talking about like 10, 11, 12-year-old girls.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. But apparently, when nobody was looking, he was into little boys as well.
Mm.
Isn't that horrible? If I'd known way back then when I had him in the ring, what I learned later, you know, did well the last few years actually. He wouldn't have got. I'd have broken every damn bone in his body, and I am capable of doing it. I've got so many ways to hurt you. I've to invent new ways to scream.
Mm. Rachel, do you have a question for Mr. Street?
So, I mean, a lot of guys, they kind of get jaded very quickly. What really invigorated you to keep going, and even with all the, you know, the drama and the stress on your body, what keeps you going for that long?
Ego. No, ego. And the fact that I absolutely love the business. It's in my blood. In actual fact, I will be 75 next month, and then my last contest was on the 14th of June last year.
Against Simon Sermon, correct?
No, he was my last but one contest.
Oh, that's right.
That was going to be my last contest, and I announced it was going to be. But I no sooner go home, and I started getting emails, and promoters are calling me, and everybody saying like, if we'd known that was going to be the last contest, we'd have been back. Oh no! Oh my goodness, we missed it. And I thought to myself, well, I sort of made up my mind on the spur of the moment anyway, so I'll go out with a lot more fanfare. And a very good friend of ours, Linda Marks, actually, she promotes, and she asked me to do it. And the fact she's a good friend of mine, and, you know, like I say, I sort of almost made up on the spur of the moment. I didn't really give people as much notice as I should have done. The one I had against Simon Thurman was the 9th of March, 2013, which funnily enough would have been my father's 103rd birthday if he'd still been alive. But I thought that was kind of appropriate, especially seeing my dad didn't like me and I didn't like him. No, my dad had me out of school working in the coal mine when I was 15 years of age. Not very nice, and I never met my dad until I was 5. He was a prisoner of war with the Japanese at that time. All this stuff is written in my books, by the way. My childhood and my father's experiences with the Japanese are all in my first book, My Pink Gas Mask. It's called My Pink Gas Mask because I was issued a gas mask during the war when I was about 3 years of age, and all the adults had like black gas masks and stuff like that, but I was just a 3-year-old kid. So I was given a pink one. It was supposed to look like less sinister and everything like that. But obviously, I thought I was the leader and everything like that, like, because I was the only one that had a pink gas mask. And I couldn't wait for Hitler to drop the gas bombs on us so I could actually wear it. My mother wouldn't let me play with it. If you play with that gas mask, you're going to break it. Then when Hitler's going to drop the gas bombs on us, you won't be able to breathe. Well, when is Hitler going to drop the bloody gas bombs? my hobbies at that time when I was a kid was going up on the mountain the next day looking for the German airplanes that had been shot down on the mountain instead of trying to find bits with a swastika on. And then the other hobby I had was, there was like lots of swamps and bogs and things like that all over the hills. I used to go looking amongst the swamps and things like that, and I'd pull out German bombs and gone in there and hadn't exploded. I had a big pile. I had my own sort of, I was sort of building up my own armament supply at the time. And I had a big supply. I had a big supply of unexploded German bombs that I hid behind a wall in our back garden at the time. And the thing is, I wanted to be a Red Indian before I ever knew anything about, even heard about professional wrestling. and I thought that the Red Indians lived in the hills all around Wales and everything. You know, I didn't realize that they lived in an entirely different country. What I planned to do when I found my tribe and joined them was I was going to give them all these bombs so they could sort of fasten to their arrows, and then instead of running around in covered wagons and everything like that and getting picked off, what we do is fire the arrows at the covered wagons, blow a space in there, then we'd charge straight in and kill everybody. I never liked cowboys. That's why I wrote that song, Something Very Strange About a Cowboy. incidentally, talking about my music, there is a company in Britain at the moment called Gods and Monsters, and they're bringing my music out on, they're reissuing everything on vinyl again.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I was, you know, I would... Yeah, Mr. Street, I was telling, this is Steven, I was telling Larry, I used to buy your cassettes and the albums, and You know, obviously I'm 43 now, and I was cleaning out a bunch of stuff that I had from boxes because I moved in the last couple of years, and I found a bunch of Adrian Street cassettes and albums, and I was so excited. I remember how I would just play them, and oh, such a pleasure. Something I want to do before I ask my question is, if you've never gone to Adrian Street's website, you know, he and Miss Linda make wrestling gear. He has artwork that he's done. You can get the albums there. There's a bunch of books. I'm just gonna name the books. My Pink Gas Mask, because these are the greatest titles of wrestling books ever, by the way. I Only Laugh When It Hurts. So Many Ways to Hurt You, Sadist in Sequins, Imagine What I Could Do to You, which was the song. My friends and I used to sing that song all the time. Violence is Golden, and The Merchant of Menace. So you definitely want to go to Bizarre Bazaar. So it's BIZARE BAZZAR.com. Mr. Street, my question for you is a little different. It's not really about wrestling at all, but you mentioned that you married Miss Linda in 2005 and you'd been together since like 1969. In the wrestling business, it's very hard for guys to hold marriages together or to have relationships for a long time. I just think, you know, you have this world of experience. You've lived this incredibly rich and full life. How have you and Miss Linda managed to stay together and make it work in such a crazy business and such a crazy life? How did you do that?
Great sex. In actual fact, whenever you get to read my books, you'll see. I mean, I was actually married before. Linda is my second wife, and I'm Linda's second husband. We were both married before. I've got three kids with my first wife, and I will always be grateful to my first wife for that because I love Linda to death, but she's really not into kids. She loves horses and she loves animals. But talk to her about children. She says, kids are all right, but she couldn't eat a whole one. she's very fond of my kids and she's very fond of my grandkids. But, you know, she would never ever have one herself. And the thing is, in a way, I guess that's something that's helped us because with my first wife, like you say, you know, restless marriages don't always last. There's all I love my kids and all that sort of thing. I was on the road all the time. I mean, whenever I did see him, you know, whenever I was home in London, you know, I had homes. I had seven houses in Manchester. My ex-wife didn't know anything about those at the time. The big house that Linda and I used to live in actually had 49 rooms. When I bought the house first, we kept finding rooms we didn't even know they were there. You know, there was something I'd think was like a big cupboard. I'd open the cupboard door, find a passageway, and there'd be four or five rooms there. You know, So the first few weeks after we actually moved into the place, we were still finding more rooms. But anyway, when I went back to London, then I'd go and live with my kids and what have you. And you know that obviously that's the reason why we didn't get married initially because. I was already married, and so was Linda. But after our first date, Linda filed for divorce, and she actually changed her name by default to Linda Street. So she's been Linda Street since 1969. But Like I said, we didn't get married until 2005.
Hmm.
Long engagement. But you know, I'm on sort of good terms with my ex-wife. Like I say, my ex-wife gave me three of the most precious things that I've ever owned, and that's three children. My oldest son, Avery. Actually, in Britain at the moment, there's a number of things going on. There is, inspired by my books, there's supposed to be a musical coming out called Exotic Adrian.
Oh my gosh.
Also, there's a feature film just called Adrian. I mean, that's a working name we've got for it at the moment. It's just called Adrian. And my oldest son, Adrian Jr., is actually co-writing it. I didn't want to co-write it myself because I'm too close to it. You know, I wanted somebody else to sort of do that. And there's a lady, her name is Joanne Randalls. She is absolutely obsessed with getting this written, and so she is the producer. She wants to produce the thing. There's going to be a Welsh co-writer, because again, like a lot of fans from Wales, you know, where I was born. So it's a co-writer. My oldest son, Adrian Jr., is going to be co-writer with those. And the funny thing is, talking about musical plays, my kids were actually brought up on Buddy Holly and Elvis Presley and all that sort of thing. I played that sort of stuff all the time when they were babies. But with the result, both my sons are really into music. My youngest son, Vince, is supposed to be one hell of a drummer. My oldest son's got two bands going. You can look them up on YouTube and what have you. One of his bands is the Silver Brazilians, and the other band is Broadway Twisters. But it's strange, because when he was over one time, I took him to Tupelo to Elvis's birthplace, and we did that great. And all the rest of it, and then we had a walk around Memphis, especially around Beale Street, and I took a photograph of him standing by a poster of Buddy Holly, and he put his glasses on, and he looked just like him. A few years later, there was a stage play called Buddy. It was a Buddy Holly story. My oldest son, Adrian Jr., auditioned for it, and he got the title role.
Wow.
He actually played Buddy Holly in the musical Buddy.
Oh, that's great. Well,
they're a very talented family.
Well, I mean, it's clear that the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree. Mr. Street, I think I can speak for Larry and for Rachel when I say this was really an honor. You're just a hell of a man. You live a complete life. I mean, we could talk to you forever. We could talk about the films that you were in, that you were in Quest for Fire and Grunt the Wrestling Movie and all the things you got to do. I mean, just a life well lived, sir. And I mean, just so much pleasure you've given so many people over the years. I have one last question, if you'll indulge us. You know, you had a wrestling school, and unfortunately, because of a hurricane, apparently it closed down. But what's one piece of advice you would give? Because a lot of the people who listen to the show are aspiring pro wrestlers. What's the number one thing you think a pro wrestler needs to focus on nowadays?
Is learn properly, do some research, be very careful. There's wrestling schools about, be very, very careful who you get to teach you. Big Billy Anderson and Jesse Hernandez had a school called the School of Hard Knocks. If you can get in with them, that's the kind of guys to go with. Jimmy Valiant's got a school, and I love Jimmy to death. You know, he's an asset to the business. But he couldn't wrestle to save his life. It's funny because after I'd opened my school, Jimmy called me and he said, "Hey, brother, brother, hey, I'm taking a page out of your book." And I said, "You're taking a page out of my book?" I said, "What are you doing, wearing lipstick?" No. He said, I've opened a wrestling school. I'm teaching wrestling. I said, "Well, Jimmy," I said, "you can do something for your students that I could never do for mine." "Oh, what's up, brother?" I said, "You can teach them everything you know about wrestling in less than 2 minutes."
Well, I have to. I got to ask one more question. What do you think, Mr. Street, of wrestling as it is presented today? For example, on like WWE television, what are your thoughts on what you see now in professional wrestling?
It's not wrestling. They've taken the wrestling out of wrestling. They've not got a clue or anything like that. They've made a professional sport into a reality show that's got little or no reality. I feel sorry for the guys because they, you know, I mean, nothing against them. If they've been taught properly, they've got some super athletes there, but like I say, they've got scriptwriters and things like that. That's not what wrestling is about. They've made it into a cartoon.
And one last thing, you know, the term professional wrestler is thrown around rather loosely these days, in my opinion. What do you think of and what do you consider to be a professional in the wrestling business?
Somebody who goes in the ring and wrestles for a start. You know, you see a lot of these guys have got big names and things like that because they're flamboyant and sort of all the rest of it, and they put sort of asses on seats and a promoter keeps them up. They get their credibility by putting somebody that hasn't got a clue on with a good wrestler, and I mean the reputation rubs off. I mean, people who don't really know what they're looking at, they think to themselves like, "Oh, you know, Dusty Rhodes must be good because he just beat Dory Funk Jr. Dory Funk Jr. is a wrestler. That guy could tear you a new bloody arsehole if he wanted to." So all of a sudden, they see somebody like Dusty Rhodes, or Busty Rose, I used to call him. Busty Rose, the American Queen. He couldn't hurt you with his bionic elbow because it'd be like being sort of whacked with a rubber hot water bottle. He's calm and all the rest of it, but the thing is, he could talk and all the rest of it. He put himself on because he was the booker, and because he was the booker and the matchmaker, it was up to him who won. So, I mean, he would go in the ring and sort of beat people who were really good, solid, real wrestlers, and people that didn't really know what they were looking at because they didn't understand wrestling imagined, "Oh, he's got to be good because he beat a fantastic wrestler like Dory Funk Jr. He must be even more fantastic." But the thing is, that's not the way it is.
One last question. My favorite part of your career was when you were in Continental Wrestling in the mid-'80s, and you were a top heel there. You were the top babyface there. It was fantastic. Could you just share a few of your thoughts on your time in Continental?
On my time in Continental? That's an awful long time. When I went in there, first of all, Austin Idol was the champion there. And as soon as I arrived, Austin Idol called me and invited me out to dinner. And if you knew him as well as most wrestlers do, you'd know that was a big deal because he will not spend a penny, the bloody tight-ass bastard. But anyway, he took Linda and I out to his favorite seafood restaurant and start talking about business. And he said, "Listen," he said, "it was me that actually got you into this territory," which was a lie, but anyway, that's beside the point. He said, "I've got a great angle and everything like that." He said, he said, you're going to be challenging me and everything like that for my title. He said, it'd be good, like, if we had this big feud going and everything like that, we'll have, like, this big grudge sort of deal going, and you can chase me for my title, like, all over the place. I thought I'd get a better idea. I thought I'd beat the shit out of you. I'll be the champion. I said, then you can chase me. But anyway, I didn't like him. He tried to pull a stunt on me where I wasn't even going to get, like, a title shot and all the rest of it. You can read the details on that in the last book that I've written. I went in the ring. I mean, he was a bodybuilder, not a wrestler. You know, it's no big deal. I know, I mean, he's twice the size I am, but, I mean, that's beside the point. Doesn't matter how big you are, if you can't fight, you can't fight, and I can. Anyway, I could have beaten him. I could have beaten the crap out of him. I could have broken his neck. I could have broken his legs. I could have broken his arms in 2 minutes if I wanted to. I beat the shit out of him. Like I said, I could have beat him in 2 minutes. I beat him in about, I think I took the title off him in 5 minutes. The extra 3 minutes was so he could feel a bit more pain. Anyway, he had one title return match with me, and I beat him up even worse. And he actually lived in this territory, but he left. Never wrestled for Continental again because he was fighting the death of me. Now, it's funny, I suspected that, but Bullet Bob Armstrong, a neighbor and a very good friend of mine, told me that just a few weeks ago. We went out and had a meal together, and he said, you know why Austin Idol left? I said, no. He said he was absolutely shit scared of you. Can you imagine? He actually lived in this area. His home was in this area, but he wouldn't wrestle us in this area anymore because he was afraid of me. And that made my day. I was happy about that. And I actually included what Bob Armstrong told me in my seventh book, Merchant of Menace.
Wow. Yeah. Mr. Street, thank you so much for doing this interview and spending this time with us. And as Steve already pointed out, to go to your website, check out all the books. And thank you so much for spending the time with us tonight.
Okay, man, have a good one.
Thank you, Mr. Street.
Okay, bye, guys.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Wow. You know, in addition to legend, Larry and Rachel, I think the term straight shooter is also overused in our society. But man, you know what I'm looking forward to? I'm looking forward to being old enough that I completely don't give a shit about who I offend or what I say. Like, I mean, that was, Larry, I have to say thank you to you. Adrian Street's one of those guys that there's just this, he just, anybody who saw him wrestle, and I mean, now I have what, 7 books to get and read? My God. just, again, bizarrebazaar.com. And, you know, I'm probably going to show up at his house now that I know that he lives in Florida. And I don't know why Rachel's laughing because she's going to be there with me. But Larry, how do you even deconstruct something like what we just heard? What's something that you particularly loved about him at Continental? And I know we got to get going soon.
Oh, well, it was that he was the top, everyone knew he was a great wrestler. And even when he was a heel and doing this outlandish gay character, it was no problem for him to become top babyface because everybody knew how good he was. But to see him do that transition and how over he was as a babyface in the mid-'80s with that character was really a sight to behold. I mean, it was really tremendous. And if Rachel doesn't go with you to his house, I'll join you. I'd love to do it.
Oh
no,
my God!
All,
that's,
all three of us. We're all three, the
tipping point road trip. God help us. I
do
feel like we did not give Empire its due, and I was reading the card, and it's so good. Larry, why don't we do this? Why don't we get ourselves a guest or two from Empire for next week, so they can talk about that big, huge show at length? Would that be cool?
Yeah, I think that would be very cool.
Yeah, why don't we do that? I mean, there's just no way we can end this show after Adrian Street in a way bigger than that. So next week, guys, let's talk about Empire. And where are you going to be this weekend, Larry? Are you going to a show?
I am going to probably go to the debut of Why We Wrestle in Cornelia.
Why We Wrestle in
Cornelia.
Yeah.
To see what transpires there and this restart.
Why We Wrestle on Saturday in the church. Definitely
the church.
Go check it out. And gosh, I guess I will, I'll see you guys next week. We're going to talk Empire. No doubt Larry's going to talk about Why We Wrestle. And we're going to talk about the fallout from everything that's happening with PCW next week. So for Larry Goodman, Miss Rachel, and myself, Stephen Platinum, Porter Dale's prodigal son, we say thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next week on The Tipping Point. When he started ripping Dusty Rhodes.
Oh,
oh
God. Thank you for listening to this podcast.
I don't think that we have collectively giggled that much on any show yet.
It was so great that he was so lucid. I was actually worried that, like, oh no, you know, what if he's not? Man, that guy's still sharp as a tack.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. And it was confirmed. Yeah, he and Miss Linda made Dude Loves Gear for Mick Foley. That was a. So, did it all. Where that bitch at?
I mean, Steve's ready to go comic book shop. Where's this girl?